Yes, it's birthday time. Monday, November 8th, 2021. We're celebrating the birthday of Bonnie Raitt, singer, who is 72, and Shirley Harvey of Cedar Falls. Shirley, you're alone today, but we're celebrating only you and Bonnie Raitt. I hope your birthday is everything you wanted it to be. Happy, happy day, Shirley. Just a celebration of another trip around the sun. If today's your birthday and you didn't hear your name, please give us a call to make sure we get your name on our birthday list. Because if we don't have your name on our list, it's because you haven't called. That number is 515-243-6833, or you can call toll-free 1-877-404-4747. Sharon and I are really glad to have you with us today. If you're listening on your television or internet or your mobile device, and you aren't a registered Irish listener, it's for the same reason your name's not on the birthday list, because you haven't called us. Again, 243-6833. You can catch a replay of today's reading at 6 p.m. and, for those who are still awake, 1 a.m. on Iris. Today's show, as many as well of our any other newspapers and programs, are available as podcasts on the website. That, again, is iowaradioreading.org. And now, again, happy birthday, Shirley. Hope your day is magnificent. Now let's go back to Sharon.
Happy birthday, Shirley. We hope you have a great day. You know, the GOP lawmakers are facing a backlash over infrastructure vote. The $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that the House approved late Friday was passed with the help of several Republicans who faced a swift backlash Saturday from their GOP colleagues. Representative Andrew Garbarino of New York was one of 13 Republicans who voted for the bipartisan bill, which passed 228-206 with some progressive Democrats voting against it. After months of being held hostage by progressive Democrats, the House was finally able to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Make no mistake, tonight's vote was about roads, bridges, and clean water. It was about real people and the tangible actions Congress could take to better their lives by rebuilding and revitalizing our nation's crumbling infrastructure. The measure is one of President Joe Biden's key domestic priorities. On Saturday, he called passage of the bill a monumental step forward as a nation. But the GOP members faced harsh criticism afterward for supporting the bill, including from fellow Republican members, Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican of Colorado, called her colleagues rhinos, Republicans in name only. Rhinos just passed this wasteful $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, says Boebert. Pelosi did not have the votes in her party to pass the garbage. Time to name names and hold these fake Republicans accountable. Representative Mary Miller, Republican from Illinois, added to the backlash, calling her colleagues who voted for the bill spineless. Only 3 days after voters rejected Biden's failed policies in deep blue, Virginia and New Jersey, 13 spineless Republicans decided to tag team with Democrats and helped pass their $5 trillion socialist takeover of our country, Miller tweets. Others chimed in as well. I can't believe Republicans just gave the Democrats their socialism bill, according to Matt Gaetz of Florida. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, tweeted that the Republicans who voted with Democrats handed over their voting cards to Pelosi to pass Biden's communist takeover of America via so-called infrastructure. But Republican Representative Adam Kissinger of Illinois, who voted with Democrats Friday, hit back at Green. Kissinger says infrastructure equals communism is a new one. Eisenhower's interstate system should be torn up, or else the commies will be able to conveniently drive Red Dawn in real life. Representatives Nicole Malliotakis of New York and David McKinley of West Virginia, Fred Upton of Michigan, Tom Reed of New York, Chris Smith of New Jersey, Don Bacon of Nebraska, Jefferson Van Drew of New Jersey, Anthony Gonzalez of Ohio, Don Young of Alaska, Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, and John Katko of New York were the other Republicans who voted for the measure. Six House Democrats, including Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, Jamal Bowman of New York, Cori Bush of Missouri, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan voted against the bill. They had sought assurances that modern Democrats would back Biden's $1.85 trillion Build Back Better budget bill before voting on the infrastructure bill. The infrastructure package allocates funding to modernize highways, rebuild water lines, add billions for electrical vehicle charging station, making it the largest transportation spending package in U.S. history. Oh, we used to see all that bipartisan happen in days of old. Gordy?
It's sad. And in a news briefing from the Associated Press on other vaccination news, Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, bristles because Big Bird got his jab. Sesame Street character Big Bird announced his coronavirus vaccination on Twitter and immediately drew fire from conservatives such as Senator Ted Cruz, who dismissed the vaccine pitch as government propaganda, ignoring the fact that Big Bird doesn't work for the government. The iconic yellow bird appeared Saturday on CNN's Town Hall, the ABCs of COVID vaccines, with journalist Erica Hill. His grandmother, Granny Bird, revealed that Big Bird would be soon receiving the vaccine. Big Bird is generally identified as perennially always being 6 years old. Federal health officials recently granted emergency use authorization to Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine for kids ages 5 to 11. That night, Big Bird tweeted, "I got the COVID-19 vaccine today. My wing is feeling a little sore, but it'll give my body an extra protective boost that keeps me and others healthy. Why, I've been told I've been getting vaccines since I was a little bird. I had no idea." Well, conservative social media personality Michael Cernovich immediately tweeted a reply, "What's the treatment for myocarditis in birds?" That was a reference to myocarditis, or heart inflammation, which is a very rare side effect of the vaccine. Cruz responded on Twitter, "Government propaganda for your five-year-old." And that drew a response from Walter Schaub, the former director of the U.S. Office of Government Ethics, who pointed out to Senator Cruz, "You are vaccinated." Plenty of commenters supported Big Bird's decision. Dr. Tom Nelson, an emergency room physician in Indiana, tweeted, "Thank you for getting vaccine, Big Bird." Well, L.A. is now going to require proof of vaccination for most indoor businesses. Los Angeles, starting Monday, is imposing one of the nation's strongest vaccine mandates. Indoor restaurants, gyms, movie theaters, malls, salons, and most city buildings will require, in addition to a photo ID, a CDC vaccination card, a scan or photograph of the card, or a digital vaccination record issued by the state, city, or your healthcare provider. The ordinance encourages businesses to offer service outside for patrons who do not provide proof of vaccination. Patrons who claim a medical or religious reason for not getting vaccinated can provide a negative coronavirus test taken within 72 hours. Venues that fail to adhere to the ordinance can face fines starting November 29th. Also in the news, an Oklahoma City school district violated state law by firing six teachers who refused to wear masks. That according to the Oklahoma governor. Five of those teachers are suing the district over the mandate and say wrongful termination will be added to the suit. From Arizona, some members of the Mojave County Board of Supervisors oppose county news releases promoting vaccinations for children. Supervisor Heldy Angius referred to vaccination for kids as insanity. School officials in Rutherford County, Tennessee are tapping COVID-19 relief dollars to offer bonuses up to $1,000 to help retain school employees. District workers employed before October 1st who remain employed with the county until December 17th will qualify for a $500 payment. Finishing the school year will bring another $500. And finally, today's numbers. The U.S. has recorded more than 46 million confirmed COVID-19 cases and 745,700 deaths. More than 246 million cases and 4.9 million deaths have been totaled in the globe. More than 192 million Americans, 57.9%, are fully vaccinated, according to the CDC. And this is a compilation of how we're all getting along with each other.
The Navy is christening a ship named after gay rights activist Milk. The Navy christened the U.S. Navy ship Harvey Milk, a fleet replenishment oiler named after a Navy veteran and one of the nation's first openly gay elected official. This great ship honors hashtag Navy diver and hashtag civil rights activist Harvey Milk, who was forced out of the service due to unfair policies. The Office of the Navy Secretary tweeted on Saturday, "Because of him, today our hashtag LGBTQ, hashtag sailors, and hashtag Marines serve honorably as their genuine selves." Former Navy officer Paula Neera, clinical program director of the John Hopkins Center for Transgender Health, smashed a bottle of champagne on the ship's bow before the launch Saturday into San Diego Bay. Milk was 48 years old and a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors when he and Mayor George Moscone were assassinated in City Hall on November the 27th, 1978. The shooter, former supervisor Dan White, was angered when Moscone declined to reappoint him to the board. Milk was posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Barack Obama in 2009. Milk joined the Navy in 1951 during the Korean War, served 4 years as an officer and dive instructor. During his time in the military, LGBTQ service members were not allowed to acknowledge their sexuality. Milk's nephew, Stuart Milk, said his uncle was forced to resign from the Navy because he was gay. Stuart Milk had attended the launch ceremony. "The Secretary of the Navy needed to be here today, not just to amend the wrongs of the past, but to give inspiration to all of our LGBTQ community leaders who served in the Navy, in uniform today, and in the civilian workforce as well," says Del Toro. to tell them that we're committed to them in the future. The ship will provide underway replenishment of fuel to Navy ships at sea and jet fuel for aircraft assigned to aircraft carriers. The ship is about 677 feet long and holds 180,000 barrels of aviation and diesel fuel. The ship's traditional sponsors are NERA and U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein from California. Feinstein was in City Hall when Milk and Moscone were shot and publicly announced their deaths a short time later. Feinstein was unable to attend the launch, but said in a letter read at the ceremony that the ship will carry a rich legacy of civic leadership. When the Harvey Milk sails, she will send a very strong message, both domestically and around the globe, to everybody that believes in freedom and justice and liberty, that there is a place for you in this family. Gordy?
And in another example of the problems with employees who quit and can't find another job they like, states are adrift because of a lack of snowplow drivers. It's an article by Doyle Rice. Several states are facing a shortage of salt truck and snowplow drivers, potentially bringing day-to-day difficulties for motorists and slowing emergency services as winter weather begins to arrive across much of the United States. Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Missouri, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Wyoming, all of which have typically snow on the roadways, are now recruiting snowplow drivers. Six of those states, Colorado, Ohio, Oregon, Michigan, Missouri, and Pennsylvania, not Iowa, are each looking to hire more than 100 people. Mark Gelb, administrator of the Transportation Systems Management Operations Division at the Michigan Department of Transportation, says it's not just for the traveling public, but it's also for emergency services, ambulance, police, and fire, and all that. We need to keep the roads clear so people can get around. Gelb said he hasn't seen a snowplow driver shortage like this during his 30 years. He added that the shortage likely is due to a competitive job market. The private sector is offering bonuses and higher wages, and it can be hard for the Michigan Department of Transportation to compete because it has preset salaries. In Ohio, the State Department of Transportation has more than 190 open positions. The Public Information Officer Matt Bruning in Ohio says, in some parts of the state, our applications are down 50% from where we would expect them to be. The good thing is, we have drivers. We have people who will get the roads clear in Ohio. How many seasonal workers we get will determine how quickly we get those roads cleared. The department has a goal to get the primary roads cleared within 2 hours of the end of a snow event and the secondary routes within 4 hours. While the department hits that goal approximately 95% of the time, this year might prove more challenging. In Colorado, the state's Department of Transportation is seeing a shortage of 19% of its snowplow operators, according to John Lormey, Director of Maintenance. Colorado has about 190 permanent positions available for entry-level maintenance, with roughly 100 other temporary positions open. Cities are also feeling the pinch of the snowplow driver shortage. In Milwaukee, that city's Department of Public Works has reported it is finding it extremely challenging to find workers to drive snowplows amid a labor shortage and competition for workers with commercial driver's licenses. Milwaukee officials are hoping a $2.59 bump in the minimum hourly pay will help head off what could be a dire staffing shortage that would likely require more time to clear snow from the roads. Another problem, Sharon.
The Poles are protesting an abortion restriction. Poland's health ministry issued instructions Sunday to doctors confirming that it is legal to terminate a pregnancy when the woman's health or life is in danger, a directive that comes amid apparent confusion over a new restriction to the country's abortion law. The document addressed to obstetrician comes in reaction to the hospital death of a 30-year-old mother whose 22-week pregnancy had medical problems. The woman died in September, but her death became widely known this month. Doctors at the hospital in, and I'm going to spell this for you, PSZCZYNA, which is in southern Poland, held off terminating her pregnancy despite her fetus lacking enough amniotic fluid to survive, her family and a lawyer stated. The doctors have been suspended and prosecutors are investigating. Angered Poles held nationwide protests over the weekend, blaming the woman's death on Poland's restrictive abortion law. Women's rights activists say it has a chilling effect on doctors in this predominantly Roman Catholic nation. The ministry stressed it is in line with the law to terminate a pregnancy when the woman's health is in danger, even more so in case of threat to her life. It included guidance in a case of premature loss of the amniotic fluid. It should certainly be stressed that doctors must not be afraid to take evident decisions stemming from their medical experience and the available medical knowledge, says the ministry. There were also 800 migrants that were rescued from a German ship. A German humanitarian ship with more than 800 rescued migrants on board, including 15 very young children, made port in Sicily on Sunday after being granted permission by Italian authorities following days of waiting in the Mediterranean Sea. The charity group CI said the vessel CI-4 was assigned to the port of Trapani in western Sicily on Saturday evening. Most of the adults were to be transferred to other ships for preventative quarantine against COVID-19, while some 160 minors, including babies and other children younger than 4, were to be taken to shelters on land. Many of the passengers came from countries in West Africa, Egypt, or Morocco. This is according to Giovanni Di Benedetto, an official from Save the Children in Italy. About half of the migrants were rescued from a sinking wooden boat Thursday, while the other passengers reached safety in separate operations. CI officials had lamented that Malta hadn't responded to the wooden boat's distress signals in the Maltese search and rescue area. Gordy?
And from Iraq, tension after a failed assassination bid. It's an article by Kasim Abdul Zahra. Troops and patrols deployed throughout Baghdad on Sunday following the failed assassination attempt with drones that targeted Iraq's prime minister at his residence. The attack significantly raised tensions sparked by the refusal of Iran-backed militias to accept last month's parliamentary election results. 7 of Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi's security guards were wounded in the attack by at least 2 drones that occurred in the heavily fortified Green Zone area. They spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to give official statements. Al-Kadhimi suffered a light cut. He later appeared on Iraqi television seated behind a desk in a white shirt, looking calm and composed, with what appeared to be a bandage on his left hand. Al-Kadhimi said during the televised appearance, "Cowardly rocket and drone attacks don't build homelands and don't build a future." Later on Sunday, he met with Iraqi President Barham Salih and headed a government security meeting. The sound of an explosion and heavy gunfire echoed across Baghdad from the direction of the Green Zone, which houses foreign embassies and government offices. Handout photos showed the damage to Al-Qadhimi's residence, including smashed windows and doors blown off their hinges. A video distributed later by security forces showed more damage. A van parked outside the residence badly mangled, a shallow crater near the stairs, cracks in the ceiling and walls of a balcony, and broken parts of the building's roof. There was also no claim of responsibility for the attack, but suspicion immediately fell on Iran-backed militias who had been publicly attacking Al-Qadhimi. They had blamed him for previous attacks on the Green Zone. The attack came amid a standoff between security forces and the pro-Iran Shiite militias, whose supporters had been camped outside the Green Zone for nearly a month. They gathered after rejecting the results of the parliamentary elections, in which they lost about two-thirds of their seats. Protests turned deadly on Friday when the demonstrators tried to enter the Green Zone. Security forces used tear gas and live ammunition. There was an exchange of fire in which one protester affiliated with the militias was killed. Dozens of security forces were injured. Al-Qadhimi ordered an investigation. On Sunday, several faction leaders dismissed the assassination attempt, suggesting it might have been staged. Sharon?
They're still looking into this probe of the concert deaths in Houston. Investigators Sunday worked to determine how eight people died in a crush of fans at a Houston music festival. As friends and loved ones mourned the victims, and a makeshift memorial of flowers and candles took shape at the site. Authorities planned to use videos, witness interviews, and a review of concert procedures to figure out what went wrong Friday night during a performance by rapper Travis Scott. The tragedy unfolded when the crowd rushed the stage, squeezing people so tightly they couldn't breathe. Bouquets, votive candles, condolence notes, and t-shirts, including a Scott shirt, were left outside the site at the NRG Park. Michael Suarez, 26, came to the growing memorial after attending the concert. He says it's very devastating. No one wants to see or hear people dying at the festival. We were here to have a good time, a great time. And it's devastating to hear someone lost their lives. The dead, according to friends and family members, included a 14-year-old high school student, a 16-year-old girl who loved dancing, and a 21-year-old engineering student at the University of Dayton. The youngest was 14, the oldest was 27. Houston officials did not immediately release the victims' names or the cause of death. 13 people remained hospitalized Sunday. Their conditions were not disclosed. City officials said they were in the early stages of investigating what caused this pandemonium at the sold-out AstroWorld Festival, an event that was founded by Scott. About 50,000 people were there. Authorities said that, among other things, they will look at how the area around the stage was designed. One concert goer said that as a timer ticked down to the start of Scott's show, held in a fenced-off parking lot, the crowd pushed forward, screaming, and panic ensued, and people began passing out. On video posted to social media, Scott could be seen stopping the concert at one point and asking for aid for someone in the audience. Security, somebody, help, really quick. Gordy?
Thanks, Sharon. And that brings us to the halfway point of today's reading of the Des Moines Register here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. All programs heard on IRIS are intended for their use. If you're not a registered IRIS listener or you would like more information about our service, please give us a call, 243-6833, or you may call toll-free 1-877-404-4800. 4747. We need to know who is listening to keep our services free. For the past 90 minutes, your readers have been Gordy Allen and Sharon Goldford. We're really glad to have you listening. As we come on to Thanksgiving, Sharon and I'm noticing we didn't read a lot of good news today. And as we head toward Thanksgiving, I, for one, would like to be thankful that we, as a society, get back together. We stop using loaded words. We stop using fake facts. We do our factual investigation, and we learn to live together. We're all in this together. We're all going to wind up the same place, and we should probably try to work together before we get there. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place. And now we welcome to the microphones volunteer readers Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. And here with the Register's opinion page is my good friend Carol.
Thank you, good friend Gordy. Censorship is unlikely to have the desired effect, is the headline. This is a Your Turn by Marty Ryan, who is the guest columnist for today. What is so attractive about shutting down the ability of another to read, see, or hear what may be offensive to you, but not to others? I feel like we're back in the 1980s when government attempted to shut down rap music, performance artists, photography by Robert Mapplethorpe, and books that had been banned in earlier decades. Recently, Toni Morrison's book, Beloved, was the focus of a political advertisement in the campaign for governor in Virginia. The novel, a Pulitzer Prize winner, is an unflinching look into the abyss of slavery. A woman in the advertisement describes how her 17-year-old white son was traumatized by reading the book as it was assigned in a high school class. The boy's mother wants the book banned from the Fairfax, Virginia schools. Well, slavery wasn't exactly as honorable as you might think. While key parents are upset that books found in a school's library are inappropriate for students of all ages because of explicit sexual content and graphic images, there are many ways to deal with printed material, movies, and music that may raise an eyebrow. Adults are responsible for talking to their children about sex, their bodies, respect, and boundaries. It's not an easy task, but whoever said being a parent was a breeze? Curiosity has been around since cats evolved. Adolescents should be able to bring questions to their parents without worrying about consequences. In the Register story on the Waukee matter, a parent found a book in his son's backpack about a boy who lives with his grandparents and is searching to discover the truth about his family. The parent said, "I cannot write what I saw, but found 33 different pages that contain sexual and or slanderous and vulgar content that, if spoken in my house, would be grounds for immediate discipline. I pity that young man who lives in his father's house and not his parents' home. When I was a young boy, a group of us, boys and girls, sat around a hi-fi set and listened to a couple of LP Adams found in a stack of a girl's mother's records. One was recorded by Red Fox. If you grew up in the 1960s, you know how dirty Fox could be, but funny. Another album we listened to was Band in Boston. None of us had adverse reactions to the material in those LPs. Supreme Court Justice, I'm sorry, that is Supreme Court Associate Justice Potter Stewart, is credited with saying, I know pornography when I see it, but I cannot define it. He didn't say that. It has been paraphrased to mean that, however. What he did say was, I shall not today attempt further to define the kind of materials I understand to be embraced within that shorthand description, hardcore pornography. And perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it, and the motion picture involved in this case is not that. The movie he was talking about was The Lovers, a 1958 French film by director Louis Malle. When books, music, and films are censored, they go underground. When anything goes underground, it's impossible to control. That's where the devil lives, isn't it? I read Catcher in the Rye when I was young. I didn't think it was that great of a book. I read it again later in life to see what I missed because it had been banned so many times. I still didn't get it. Not only that, but once again, I didn't think that it was a great piece of literature. I'm surprised no adult stopped me from reading Wild in the Streets around the same time. I loved that book, and it had more anti-authoritarian passages than Catcher in the Rye. Decades ago, if a book, play, movie, or music was banned in Boston, it was an indication that the material was on its way to being a bestseller. I'm sending my first book to Boston in hope that the Watch and Ward Society will recommend that it be banned. And again, this is by Marty Ryan, and he is from Des Moines and retired after lobbying the Iowa legislature for 27 years. Jeff?
Let's turn to the letters to the editor for today. The first, entitled, The Nature of Climate Change Should Be Evident to Ernst. This is submitted by Kim Hageman of Polk City. Kim writes, I recently received a response from Senator Joni Ernst to a letter I sent concerning action on climate change. Turns out she is willing to believe that climate change is happening, but isn't convinced that the change is necessarily due to human activity. Well, I'm not a climatologist, but I believe experts. I also can easily understand that when the composition of the atmosphere is altered, it can cause the physical properties of our atmosphere to change. It is comparable to high-efficiency thermal windows. In order to increase the efficiency, windows may have a gas such as argon placed between the panes. When humans take millions of tons of coal and natural gas from underground and burn it every hour of every day, they release greenhouse gases into our atmosphere. When humans change the landscape from prairies and forests to buildings, roads, high-density livestock operations, and row crops, they decrease the amount of carbon dioxide being taken out of the air by plants and increase the amount of methane released into the air by ruminant animals and waste decomposing in anaerobic conditions. These human actions are altering the composition of the atmosphere, resulting in more carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases. This is causing the energy from the sun to enter the atmosphere and be captured more than an atmosphere without such carbon dioxide, methane, and so forth. This capture of energy is causing the temperature of the Earth to rise and therefore causing changes in glacier formations, ocean currents, weather patterns, rainfall, all resulting in climate change. Senator Ernst, I don't know your reasoning for not understanding, but the result of your lack of understanding and therefore inaction is going to make everyone's future in Iowa much more miserable and, for many, more deadly. The second letter is from Savannah Rock in Des Moines. Make Des Moines better for blind persons. In Iowa alone, an estimated 54,000 people are visually impaired. This accounts for 3.71% of the population, compared to the national percentage of 2.94%. The Iowa Department for the Blind is located on 4th Street in downtown Des Moines. On any given day, one can drive throughout downtown and see groups of low vision or blind persons walking on sidewalks. Frequently, they're paused at an intersection waiting for the light to change in order to safely cross the street. A limited amount of traffic signals come with an accessible pedestrian signal, which is a push button at a traffic signal that provides audible cues to let pedestrians who are blind or low vision know when to cross the street. I recently spoke with a representative of the City of Des Moines regarding the status of traffic signals. There are currently 425 traffic signals in Des Moines alone. Of those 425, only 25 are equipped with APS, that's accessible pedestrian signal. There are currently 35 mid-block traffic signals, and of those 35, 10 are equipped with APS. Within 5 years' time, though, all mid-block traffic signals will be equipped with APS. So, yes, the city is taking strides, but is there more that can be done? Again, that letter of great interest to our listeners, submitted by Savannah Rock of Des Moines. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And the next article comes from Leonard Pitts, who is a columnist for the Miami Herald. And this article is entitled, "We're Better Off Without Officers Who Decline Vaccines." It's been reported that 34 New York City police officers took unpaid leave rather than comply with that city's vaccine mandate. For this, New Yorkers should thank them and then find a way to fire them. Supposedly, according to the city's police unions, as many as 10,000 uniformed officers out of about 35,000 had been set to walk off the job. To have only a tiny fraction of that number carry out the threat is something of a relief. But yes, the city owes thanks to the 34 cops who did, because that was an act of public service, meaning that they outed themselves as officers who were likely unfit for duty. Valid medical and religious exemptions aside, it seems reasonable to suspect a high correlation between refusal to obey vaccine mandates and susceptibility to the right-wing extremism, outlandish conspiracy theories, and utter disconnect from reality that have ignited vaccine and mask mandate resistance for the better part of 2 years. As was made clear by the fact that sworn officers took part in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, the ranks of law enforcement have been infiltrated by radicalized cells of these so-called conservatives. Anything that roots them out is something for which Americans should be grateful, and if they are willing to self-identify, to, in effect, hold up their hands and be counted, so much the better. It is hard to get a handle on the size of this movement. Is it a minuscule splinter of the total force, as New York would seem to suggest? Or is it more? One hopes it is the former, but even if it is the latter, we're still better off doing without them than caving in to them. Yes, losing a critical number of police officers would constitute a threat to public safety, but so would leaving unvaccinated officers in place to interact daily with an unsuspecting public. And that's just in the short term. Over the long term, there is another, arguably greater, concern, meaning that of leaving law enforcement power in the hands of those who clearly don't respect the law, who think themselves above it. People often rhapsodize about police as a thin blue line standing between us and social chaos. The fact that chaos is hard upon us is obvious from the perusal of any random day's news. Last week, for instance, hundreds of QAnon followers stood in the rain in Dallas's Dealey Plaza, where John F. Kennedy was murdered on November 22, 1963, waiting for the return of his namesake son, who died in a plane crash on July 16, 1999. Note that this act of mass lunacy barely penetrated public consciousness. It's a bad sign when the breakdown of norms becomes the norm. Worse, too, many police are now to be found on the other side of that breakdown, contributing to it instead of defending against it. Refusing to obey duly constituted authority by taking a shot? Really? That's a dereliction of duty for which the entire profession should be ashamed. Make no mistake, to lose 34 cops, or 3,400, or 34,000, is to lose a critical investment in time, training, and human capital. But to lose them in this way and for this reason is also to separate wheat from chaff. When you put on that badge, it means something, that you now work for your fellow citizens, that you represent an ideal, and that you uphold the law, part of which is obeying the law. Any cop who can't do that shouldn't be a cop in the first place. And again, that article was from Leonard Pitts, columnist for the Miami Herald. Jeff, back to you.
Thanks, Carol. We'll switch to the opinion section of the USA Today. A piece from Daniel Darling, who is director of the Land Center for Cultural Engagement at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. He is the author of a book called Away with Words. Darling's piece is entitled Evangelicals Need to Admit Our Failures, but We Also Must Hold On to Our Hope. In 1976, the cover of Newsweek declared that, with a presidential election that featured the born-again Jimmy Carter, it was the, quote, year of the evangelical, end quote. 45 years later, the news media fascination with my spiritual family has not abated. From the heady days of 2004, when once again evangelicals were crowned a defining political force, to this moment, when a cottage industry of books laments our influence, the world has looked in on us and we have looked in on ourselves and have asked a perennial question, what is our future? In one sense, this is a question born out of a variety of factors owing to the tumult of the hour. We live in the digital age where every voice can be heard, where every family disagreement is public, where there is no such thing as an unheard opinion. We're also riven by social chasms, splitting society, sorting as we were over shared hatreds shaped by politics, race, and global pandemic. And there has been an epidemic of scandals among evangelical institutions, moral failures and abuses of power brought to light in the past several years. Many are questioning the future of the movement. Some predict it will split left, right, and center, mirroring the divide that among mainline denominations at the turn of the 20th century. Some have created complex taxonomies to map out the various tribes. Others wonder whether the term evangelical is still worthy, fraught as it is with political and social baggage. As the son of parents converted after Billy Graham's crusade stopped in Chicago in 1971, I have these same questions. Yet I can't bring myself to quit. Neither the term that loosely defines us nor the institutions that have shaped us. Though, like most, I don't walk around calling myself an evangelical. I see myself first as a Jesus follower, then as a Baptist Christian. Yet the term evangelical is perhaps the only one that best fits the trans-denominational movement that binds our people along doctrinal and social lines. At our best, we are not a voting bloc, but a people defined by the good news of grace that first rocketed out of a backwater Roman province more than 2,000 years ago. A healthy evangelicalism will not look for something altogether new and innovative, but will constantly seek renewal by seeking what the prophet Jeremiah described as the old paths, the well-worn body of truth passed down from generation to generation. Our current dysfunction is not a problem of theology, but of formation. We need to return to serious discipleship as a bulwark against the false catechisms of the age, those engines of toxicity flooding our social media and shouting at us on our televisions and sandpapering our souls through our earbuds. The antidote to this rootless pop spirituality is not to abandon orthodoxy, but to dive more deeply into it. Evangelicalism needs a thick denominationalism, where local churches shape spiritual lives weekly through vibrant rhythms of worship and practice. Our movement also needs a renewal of our key institutions and a vision to build new ones. Expressive individualism is seductive, a temptation toward cheap heroism on social media, the attraction of seeing oneself as a brand. Ultimately, we serve best when we serve as we were created, in community. Institutions are vital for human flourishing, and yet at so many levels they have failed us in recent years, breeding deep distrust and cynicism. What's needed in this moment is a fresh appraisal of our models of leadership. For too long, we've prioritized giftedness over godliness, ignoring deficits of character in favor of charisma. We are so entranced with leaders who can move a room, we fail to ask whether those same leaders are worthy of their calling. Yet, in the midst of our brokenness, we should not miss what God is doing. There are opportunities for renewal if we are committed to being people repentant and humbled by the Spirit of God. The world needs a movement committed to the Bible's version of dignity, a movement that resists the tribalism that sorts people based on shared hatreds. We must be people of hope and not fear, believing that this is not a world that has ended the guiding providence of a loving God. Christians were made for this moment, so we must believe that the same gospel that turned frightened fishermen into fearless martyrs is transforming souls today. Because we know our history and because we know our future, we can engage the culture with confidence and compassion. We can love our neighbors by helping to shape the social structures that lead to their flourishing. We can be unflinching about those things we know to be true, and yet open-minded where people of goodwill disagree. The Bible gives no guarantee that this faithfulness will result in more or less influence, but we can live with hope wherever we find ourselves, whether advocating in the halls of power or administering relief in a refugee camp. Because ultimately, we know a future not bound up in the uncertainty of the next election, but in the reality of our future resurrection. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And from the Des Moines Register, Des Moines Clinic provides booster shots. This article is by Amber Momand from USA Today. Broadlands Medical Center and the United Way of Central Iowa hosted a COVID-19 vaccine clinic on Saturday aimed at marginalized communities in Des Moines that may have fallen through the cracks of the medical care system. The goal? To get 300 people vaccinated with the COVID-19 booster shot. What brought us all together was public health and COVID-19, said Broadlands community advocate and former state representative Wayne Ford. So the pressure that they have on each other is to continue this, make this a model program for America and how we could come together for public health and to make our community more balanced. This was the third vaccination clinic, following those held for people to get their first and second rounds of the COVID-19 vaccine. A total of 1,113 individuals received the COVID-19 vaccine at the first two clinics. Of those, 60% were people of color, and 95% of those who got their first dose came back for the second. Ford said they could have gone to Hy-Vee, they could have gone to Walgreens, but they came back because of the relationship we started. They waited for us to come back, and that is so special. The location, Corinthian Baptist Church, was chosen to make the clinic accessible, to create a feeling of comfort and familiarity for those who attended. Historically, there's always been a divide in a lot of different communities, Will Cowan of Des Moines told the Register after he got his booster shot. And so having clinics like this inside the community, I think it's going to develop trust, and I think it's going to bring people together. Cowan was initially skeptical of the vaccine's effectiveness on those who are immunosuppressed, he said. But after Colin Powell, the first black U.S. Secretary of State, died of COVID-19 complications, Cowan decided to get the booster shot. Cowan said, "He is someone I looked up to, and he was immunosuppressed. He was fighting cancer, and he died before he could get his booster shot." And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm immunosuppressed. I'm going to go get my shot. Although 65% of Iowans have had at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, a quarter of Iowa adults do not plan to get vaccinated against the coronavirus, according to the latest Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll. A Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll from March found that 27% of white adults and 29% of non-white adults don't plan to be vaccinated. Cowan was pleased to be part of the majority on this issue. A lot of people are concerned about equality and advocacy. I think that needs to start at home. That's what Cowan said. You need to be an advocate for yourself. You need to fight for your own health and then expand that out to your community. And it's only a couple minutes before our short break, before our obituary, so I'll just read a little bit of this article. New Kroger membership will offer free delivery on orders over $35. Kroger has announced it's launching a membership program called Boost, which will offer customers double gas points and free deliveries for online orders of $35 or more. They're being introduced in Greater Cincinnati as well as stores throughout Atlanta, Columbus, and Indianapolis regions. And Boost will expand to other parts of the country next year. Kroger hopes double gas points will draw legions of customers to become members as gas prices soar nationwide in 2021 to levels not seen in 7 years. Customers will still max out their savings at $1 off per gallon, but they'll hit that limit twice as fast. Stuart Aiken, Kroger's chief merchant and marketing officer, said, "It's the perfect time to launch with double fuel points. If you go to the gas station right now, it's more than it's been in a long time, so it's a great deal for customers." Kroger sold $9.5 billion in gas in 2020, making it the nation's number one fuel retailer. It operates nearly 1,600 fuel centers. Jeff?